reach the Outrider Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 14 of the Outrider Podcast. I, of course, am Jason Quinn Malott. Today we have, well, before we get to me telling you about today's guest, let's first put out a little request. If you happen to listen to this on iTunes or Stitcher, if you would, please go to that site and rate and comment on the podcast and tell us what you think, and hopefully you think good things. But let's get some ratings on this thing. Even if you don't listen through iTunes or Stitcher, but you have an iTunes account or a Stitcher account, find us on the on those websites and give us a little rating. That would be great and helpful. So anyway, today's guest is Teresa Romaine. Teresa is a romance writer, and you might be wondering, well, what are you doing talking to romance writers? She's a writer. She's a friend of mine, and I think she's great. I've read some of her books. I will read some more. and also, I think it would be beneficial for me and some writers that I know to pay attention to some genre writers. Like Teresa and my friend Jen, who was the first guest of the Outrider Podcast, who writes a lot of sci-fi and fantasy and alternative things. Anyway, let's see here. Teresa, she has two series going right now. The oldest one is the Holiday Pleasures series, or the Season series, whichever you want to call it. Those include Seasons for Temptation, Season for Surrender, and Season for Scandal. Those are all out in the bookstores now. The last one, Season for Desire, or that'll be the most recent one, that'll come out in October, so keep an eye out for that if you're into Regency romance. She also has the Matchmaker trilogy out there. It Takes Two to Tangle was released in 2013. The new one, To Charm a Naughty Countess, will be out next month in May, so be on the lookout for that one. And, of course, she's already got the third one of the trilogy ready to go. That'll be out in January of 2015, and that one's called Secrets of a Scandalous Heiress. I hope you enjoy this conversation, and Teresa and I had a hoot with it. We always do have good conversations when we talk to each other, and it's always fun. So I hope you will enjoy this conversation as much as I did. So let's get right to Teresa Romaine.
Let me tinker with that a little. Hi, okay. I'm a couple minutes early, but I thought I'd just see how the sound sounded. I have coffee. Is it gross if I take a drink of coffee while we are
absolutely not, because
okay, it's the fuel. Yeah, okay,
well, mine's actually a chai, and I always drink something when I'm doing the whole podcast thing. Sometimes it's a beer or a glass of wine, but that's usually for the later in the afternoon stuff,
you know. It is afternoon. So if you want to get something, I'm not going to tell.
Well, I finished it all off like Thursday night.
Oh.
I'm currently without alcohol. Well, I take that back. I have a little bit of rum left and some gin. But that's some more
hardcore
of
hardcore for 1 p.m.
1 p.m., yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, stick with the beer and the wine in the afternoon, because you don't want to be an alcoholic, obviously.
Well, although I've heard it said it's only alcoholic if you drink alone, or if you can't, like if you have to have it, and if you're drinking alone, and you know, this is not alone if we're chatting, so I'm cool with whatever. But I'm glad. Yeah, I start really needing coffee this time of day.
I understand.
Actually,
I understand
all times of day. So,
well, you know, I hit the recorded button as soon as you called in, so we're rolling.
Okay.
And I'll do an intro to make sure everybody knows who you are.
Okay.
But, you know, we had a great conversation. What was it, about a year ago now?
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. Yeah.
I guess it was.
Right when F5 was getting started up.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, I wasn't able to use all of that conversation in that little article, you know, time, space, word count, all that stuff.
Right, right.
And I thought, well, let's do it again. Let's actually give it a shot and see if we can sort of recreate it.
Yeah. You know. Well, and this time I won't knock coffee over to your recorder. I may knock over my own coffee with my inability to control my hand gestures, but you're good over there.
Well, good. Well, it would have been okay either way. I've got, I have, you know, mics on booms and all sorts of stuff now. So we would have had everything up and away.
Oh, fancy.
Right, right. Well, let's for the sake of my audience, which is probably small and diffused and probably not a lot of romance readers, let's do your origin story, since you have a secret identity and are a superhero.
Well, yes. Among my superpowers are walking into door frames that do not change location, writing solely with my left hand and being unable to do anything with the right, and seeing very badly.
Right.
So, you know, the usual writer stuff, I think. Because I'm just, it's a good job for me because I tend to be unaware of my surroundings and always creating my own little world. Well, I write historical romance under the name Teresa Romaine, which is my real name, only chopped down a little, because I figured that was easiest not to stray too far from reality for someone who walks into door frames. And I studied psychology and English and history in college, in grad school, which I never really knew where I was going with that, but it turned out to be kind of the perfect background for a genre that just really digs into character. Mm-hmm. The books are all about the character. They have a reputation among people who maybe haven't picked one up for being all about the sex, but it's not true. You're laughing. That's a part of it, but it's all within the development of character.
Right.
And
it's like that with everything except, I think, pornography.
You know, I think the development of character and of love relationships among adults is realistically always going to involve a sexual element, but it's just how much of it is on the page or not. And I'm talking about books here, not real life. That fiction tends to maybe intensify things more than real life.
Well, I think it has to, just as a general rule. We have to kind of
leave out the boring bits.
Leave out the boring bits. I mean, God, imagine how long a novel would be if we had to make sure that our characters went to the bathroom on a regular basis.
Or that you can't just drink a cup of coffee without grinding the beans, putting the filter in, et cetera.
Right.
Et cetera. Yeah, right, right, exactly.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to add. So I've been writing historical romance for the past couple of years, but I also have used all of that liberal arts stuff to do medical editing, too. That was my first job out of grad school, and I still do it on the side. And I think that helps, too, because I have to account for every word and make sure everything is making sense.
Right.
And so it's made me a more conscious writer, I think.
Okay. Well, let's back up a little bit, because you went into graduate school, right? And that was history, correct?
Yep.
And you did end up writing one book under your human identity. And that was, I'm going to blank on the name of the subject.
Oh, check it out. Because we're here in my office. And that means we have my shelves next to me. So it's called Margarita Fisher, A
Correct.
Biography of a Silent Film Star, because I really love silent film, and I think it's probably the same reason that I love historical romance. It's a snapshot of a time that we want to understand, and so we're trying to get close to it by looking at the evidence that's left. And so yes, so that was under my human name, and it's an academic
You want to
page.
spill what that is, or do we want to keep the illusion?
It's on the copyright page of all my books, but I don't bring it up because I like to keep a little veil between the human world and the superhero world, because my family didn't pick any of this. They're really supportive and they're along for the ride, but I never use their names online or post pictures or anything like that. I'm perfectly willing to post humiliating anecdotes and pictures of myself, but not of them. But yeah, that's that.
Nobody but us writers here.
Those were my stretching sounds as I put the book back on the bookshelf for the sake of the recording.
And okay. So, how long between the time when you finished that book and started doing the medical editing before you wandered into the world of
Of his.
series romance?
I am a little too anxious and compulsive to do one thing at a time. So when I started working in the medical field, I was not quite done with grad school yet. I had a couple months to go. I still had to defend my thesis. And so after I finished that, my advisor told me, I think you have enough material here to turn it into a book. And so I worked on that outside of my day job for several years. And I had a contact with a great publisher who has a very strong interest in silent film. So I ran the proposal by them and they said, okay, well, finish it and then we'll be glad to take a look at it. So I want to say I finished it around June of 07, I think, is when I turned it in. And then I had a baby. So that came next. And my husband and I had been talking about it for a while, and that seemed like a great time when I wasn't working on a book anymore. It's like all I'm doing is working now. Let's have a child. 'Cause I hear that's totally easy and not time consuming at all.
Oh yeah, those things, you know, when they get in the way, you just put them in a corner and they take care of themselves.
Right, yeah. Give them a couple pieces of candy and
Oh yeah, there you
for the sake of any SRS people who may be listening, we're totally kidding. We're totally kidding. But that wasn't enough because the compulsion hit again. Like, well, she's not born yet, so I could be doing something else. And I really enjoyed reading historical romance since I had worked at a library while I was an undergrad. And I saw what people were checking in, checking out, and I'd grab a book and give it a read. And I started to really like reading historical romance. So I thought, I don't know if I have another nonfiction book in me, but let me try writing one of these books that I enjoy reading. And so I started it before my daughter was born. And I joked to people, that's why the main character in that first novel is hungry all the time. She is she's a very family first character, and she is always hungry. That's probably as much of myself as I've ever put into a character. And the first draft sounded like nonfiction. I didn't know what I was doing, but I wrote it and rewrote it slowly, especially after our daughter was born. And it was about a year after she was born, I guess, that I entered it in some romance writing contests, and that's how I connected with the woman who's still my editor. for my season series, my holiday pleasures romances.
Right. Okay.
So it was a
Now,
long timeline, a very twisty process.
well, comparatively, not that long, really. Some of us took 7 years after finishing a draft to actually land a publisher. But
Is
you know,
that
different.
hypothetical?
No, that was how long it took me.
Oh my gosh. Is it
Yeah.
really?
I finished Shadows in 2001, 2000, yeah, 2001, about the same time that I finished graduate school and, you know, started sending it out. And then 9/11 happened.
Oh, yeah.
And there's always a little part of me that wonders how many of the rejection letters I got were because my main character was Muslim.
Well, I didn't think that was a really big element. I mean, there's so much to Emil, but you may have to correct my pronunciation of some of the characters' names because I do not know any Eastern European languages. But that was obviously an important part of his character, but it wasn't the most prominent fact. But maybe the wartime setting, that people wanted to read about unicorns and rainbows more. I don't know. There's some imagery that might have made them uncomfortable at the time, but
True. And
it
it
wouldn't be
was,
true without it. It wouldn't be true without it.
and the book was definitely sympathetic to the Muslims in Bosnia, which also, I mean, aside from just the main character, there was a definite I mean, that's but anyway, I don't know. I can't say for sure about any of that,
Sure.
but
It's so much a matter
so.
of luck and timing, and you never know. Well, I'm really glad it found a home. I didn't realize the
Me
process
too.
had been so long.
Yeah. Well, I was one of those writers who took the well, you know, unlike the with the romance thing, and then with a lot of other stuff, there's and a lot of the other genre stuff, there's not a big there is a network for literary writers, but it's insular and tracked and there's a book I'm reading out right now called MFA versus NYC. It's an anthology put together by Chad Harbach, who wrote this novel, The Art of Fielding.
Okay.
And it's kind of this look at how there are two centers of literary fiction in America. Now, of course, he's a little bit biased. There's this whole other section, which is the genre, the popular stuff, which doesn't fall under the literary rubric of New York and under the MFA rubric. But he's talking about how there's this it came from an essay that he wrote that showed up in one magazine somewhere, Slate maybe. That we've created this one thing where there's the MFA on one side that's all focused on short stories and the long haul, you know, there's you know and centered around the universities and this little tiny self-perpetuating system. And then there's the New York City thing, which is slowly trying to turn everybody into celebrities. And a writer really only is a celebrity when they have a new book come out, and they just slowly get forgotten until the next book comes out. And it's this weird amalgam of commerce and art, which
And you
and
thought
there's
that book m made some good points that rang true to you?
well, and I haven't finished the MFA thing. It's a whole bunch of
Oh.
essays that he put together from other writers about it, and it's mostly focused on the literary scene. And there's that track,
Sure.
and I'm not in New York City, so I'm not part of that track for literary fiction. And I missed or didn't get, or somebody offered and I didn't pick it up. Who knows what happened? I didn't get my appointment to an MFA program. So I'm not teaching short fiction and going around and doing readings at other MFA programs. And I'm not, one of the things about the MFA program or the MFA cycle is that it's because they're employed by the universities, it removes from them that economic pressure to publish a certain at a certain level and at a certain frequency.
Okay.
They can focus on short stories and unread journals and not worry about making money with their writing because they're getting paid by the university. And then the New York City group, they're always worried about making money. And so they tend to write books down to, you know, easily digestible, quick, almost formulaic stuff. Stuff that's not difficult, that's not open-ended, that's not... Now, this is, of course, on the literary track, not genre. Genre is its own beast. But we'll talk about that some more later because I actually have some ideas.
Oh.
One of the things that I enjoy talking to genre writers about is what we'll get into later, but I have some questions for you and all that good stuff.
All right.
But, yeah, it's...
So you feel like you're outside both tracks.
I'm definitely outside of it.
Do you feel more at home with one or the other, or do you feel like...
Not anymore.
Okay.
I mean, when I was in the MFA program, that's where I wanted to be. I wanted to teach creative writing, be at a university, because then I would get health insurance and have an income.
You know, those things are
marvelous, aren't they?
They're really important, yeah. I'm not going to ding either of those things.
Yeah, that's kind of why I have a day job that I don't talk about now. So
yeah, you gotta pay the bill. Yep.
Yeah. But one of the things I'm curious about, with what you're doing, is since we last talked,
mm-hmm.
let me pull up because I've got your webpage right here.
Ooh.
When we last talked, you had. You had two books out, Season for Temptation and Season for Surrender.
Yes.
Scandal was about to come out, as was It Takes Two to Tangle.
That sounds right. If it was last summer?
Yeah.
Around then? Yeah. Those came out back to back, actually, from two different publishers last
Correct.
Fall. So I quickly went from having two books out to four books out.
And almost immediately you're going from having four books out to six because you have To Charm an Naughty Countess in May and Season for Desire in October of this year.
Yes. And actually by next year at this time, I'll have seven because the third book in that trilogy of It Takes Two to Tangle, mm-hmm. To Charm a Naughty Countess, the third book is called Secrets of a Scandalous Heiress, and it'll
right.
be out in January. And I've just seen cover art for it. It's beautiful. So,
that
makes it seem a little more real.
Right. That's for a lot of people that I've talked to on the podcast previously, and for a lot of people who are in my audience, a few hundred people so far, or maybe more. I don't know. I don't know how to read my download stuff.
What's up?
But that's quite a treadmill they've got you on.
Well, it's not as fast of a treadmill as it may seem because mm-hmm. There was a 2-year delay between the time my first book was bought and it was published.
Right.
And I continued writing during that time. And so I developed a backlog, a lot of which wound up having to be revised and reworked before it could find a home. But I can't really write that fast. I had deadlines for two different publishers over the last 15 months or so.
Okay.
And I wound up writing a new book about every 6 months, like a completely new from scratch, not a work, mm-hmm. anything like that. Every 6 months or so. And that is tiring, but it's doable. So that's what I have found
right.
for myself. I know some authors can write even more quickly than that,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't yet been able to make a story take shape in my head more quickly.
It still sounds really, really fast for me. It takes me at least a year to get a rough draft out, and it's And I know that there are other, I know some other writers that sometimes take a little bit longer with that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I'm always curious about is what's taking place constructively? What's going on? Well, I guess, you know, you're doing that mostly full time then, right?
Yeah, I write almost every day. The nice thing about working from home, and the not nice thing, is that you can always go to work. You can always go to work for another hour late at night or in a weekend afternoon. And I still do health editing as well, but I spend more time on the fiction writing.
Right. Wow. One hand, I'm kind of jealous. On the other hand, I'm glad I don't have someone putting a deadline on me every year. There would be some rebellion going on there.
Cool. Well, I want to be the good author, so I keep getting contracts. But, you know, then you have an agent to be the bad cop.
Mm-hmm.
Or just a little more. I shouldn't say bad cop because my agent is an awesome cop. She's a superhero. Just to make sure that from the business standpoint, everything's running smoothly. Yeah.
Do you feel like it sometimes forces you to take shortcuts as an artist, as a writer, with how you develop characters or how you shape relationships or plots or anything like that?
No, not with the characters, because to me, digging deeply into a character is the part that's the most meaningful and the most fun. As I go through different layers of character and the story kind of unfolds in these ways that surprise me, that's really what I love about it. And so I don't know that I could take a shortcut and still be able to come up with a coherent story.
Right.
But I will say something that gives me a lead, a head start on creating a story is knowing the setting and often having books that are connected. So unlike with a literary novel, I'm not starting totally from scratch with a fictional world every time. I know that I'm setting this book usually in the late Regency, the late 18 teens. I will choose a particular part of Great Britain, often depending on a real life historical event that I can hook into. And in the case of both series that I have released so far, there are continuing characters that help the writing go more quickly too. It's like, oh, I already know these people. I know what they would do.
Right.
I'm not just forming everything out of the ether every time.
Right. Kind of like the writer of detective series, who's got that detective that carries the through line.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's another type of genre fiction. And I think having any kind of a connected series probably helps, maybe not the first book, but the later ones to come together a little more quickly because there are already some things that are established.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, I have a friend from graduate school that she and I, when we were, you know, back in young and combative, used to argue about, you know, genre and literary and everything like that. And one of the things, well, there are two things I want to ask you. One that has in two different directions. So we're just going to go with this.
All right.
We always used to argue about, you know, the usefulness of genre and the fact that there are some bad practitioners, especially in genre, who really just over rely on stereotypical characters and cliche and have constructed for themselves a formula on how to write this particular story. And they just plug in the components each time around. And those are the ones you often see out, you know, with like the one day seminar on how to write a novel.
Oh,
you know, because they've got this thing they do. They've figured out some kind of system that works for them, and so they're going to market it. But on the other hand, what I see going on a lot in the publishing world is this ever fracturing of the audience into their little isolated cliques. They've recently come out with this new genre they're calling young adult, or not young adult,
new adult.
You've heard about this?
Oh yes, yeah.
I want to like shoot myself in the head every time I hear that. It's like, really? That we need to step them into adulthood even more than we already do? I mean, I was in high school, and I was, you know, the stuff that they were calling young adult when I was in high school was just awful, cheesy, you know, just for someone who was like me, who was, you know, already an advanced reader, had and could comprehend and understand, you know, stuff way beyond my age. The stuff they were trying to, shove off as young adult was like, that's really immature. And so, you know, I was a sophomore, junior in high school, whatever, and I was, you know, partly to just shock people and partly because it was what interested me, was carrying around Salman Rushdie's The Satanic Verses.
Oh, gosh. You were a fun kid.
Well, you know.
Well, but you said what I would put this at the core of all book marketing and about all readership. You carried it around because you liked it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe there are, I don't know too much about who might be giving a writing seminar, who's also writing genre fiction. I know the genre itself has changed a lot in the last 30 years. It's changed a lot in the last 15 years. And, but for every author who's out there, there are readers that person will connect with. And who knows why?
Oh, sure, sure.
Who knows why? Maybe it's a character thing. Maybe it's a plot thing. Maybe it mm-hmm. has to do with your own emotional response. Like, oh, this reminds me of the books I enjoyed when I was whatever age. Mm-hmm. And so there are definitely books that I would say are not to my taste, but...
Oh, sure, sure.
As far as... Well, we could even say there are books that we would consider not good outside of our taste, but somewhere there's someone who thinks it's good. So,
yeah, unfortunately, you know, every writer is somebody's favorite writer, whether they're writing highbrow literary stuff or yeti bondage fiction. You know, it's...
You've been Googling.
Oh, I have. somebody, I think it was my friend... God, his name's right there on the tip of my tongue. His first novel was a young adult novel called With or Without You. Brian Ferry. Brian Ferry. He was the one that pointed out to me that there was a trend for a while in the underworld of literary publishing of dinosaur porn.
That was not too long ago.
Yeah. Right. And now it's Yeti porn, so yeah, there's, but my problem really stems from is that because we've allowed the publishing industry to so fracture things down into these little subgenres that people can essentially ghettoize themselves. Mm. And
you mean authors or readers?
Both.
Oh.
And when you allow authors and readers to ghettoize themselves, you then, you know, you have this situation where somebody can say, oh, I only read X, and there's no adventure, there's no experience, there's no surprise. You know, if all you're into is supernatural vampire yeti bondage, there's
that's really specific.
Well, I'm saying that's where we're going. And that's all you're ever going to read. There's no chance for there's no chance for surprise. There's no chance for discovery. There's no chance to find the thing that subverts what you already know and expect of the world, which is one of the strengths, I think, of all reading.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I see your point. But there are people who read for comfort. They're not looking for anything, but they're looking for something they know they're going to enjoy because they've enjoyed books like that before. However, I will say, even if you read only within a specific genre, if you read deeply, you'll still find surprises. If I were to only read historical romance mm-hmm. for a year, but if I read all the historical romances I could find, mm-hmm. man, there are fantastic books. You know, they're set in different parts of the world. They're set in different time periods. There may be heroines who are scarred and rakish and dominant, and mm-hmm. heroes who are the nice ones. You know, different authors are always flipping things around. So I'm just sort of, you know, coming from a genre that doesn't always get a lot of respect, I'm like, man, mm-hmm. live and let live. You know, if you like it, read it. That's cool. And I like to read not only historical romance, mm-hmm. but I've talked to some people who say that that is all they read, but they'll, if anything's a historical romance, they'll pick it up. And so they wind up reading books set in the Middle Ages, in mm-hmm. Turkey. It's not maybe so narrow as it seems from outside the genre.
Right. And I'm not saying that I dislike the idea of genre. There's a certain level of genre that is important as far as identification goes. What I'm worried about is that because one, you allow the ghettoization into these various micro genres, but because the publishing industry keeps creating new genres in order to as a marketing tool to describe something, that leads them then to establish guidelines for this makes it a romance, this makes it a whatever, and that anything that doesn't fit those guidelines, they don't know what to do with.
Well, that can definitely be true. And like, where does it go in the bookstore?
How do we sell this? And it's like, just sell it. You know,
but it's about, like, what buzzwords do you use to connect with people and let them know, hey, this is the kind of book you might like. And I see what you mean. And I've heard from fellow authors that when you write a book that crosses genres, like it's a sci-fi romance, which section does it go in?
Right. I mean, because a lot of publishers, particularly the big ones in New York, who are busy pulling their hair out and panicking over the so-called death of literature, when you have those writers out there that are doing something interesting, they're taking romance and some detective and some sci-fi and you know, mushing it all together because there's some weird story, and unless that writer has some kind of established reputation so that they can at least sell to the people who like author X.
Yeah.
You know,
it can be hard to find that publishing hook.
Where do you find that publisher? I mean, I think that is detrimental to the literary landscape, whether you're a romance writer or a literary writer, or your particular strength is mystery, but you happen to throw in some other stuff from other genres. Mm-hmm. By creating those breakdowns like that and allowing the readers to ghettoize themselves like that, it hurts. It actually ends up hurting the next generation of writers because they do feel like they have to
Right in a box.
Right in a box. They have to sublimate and repress that weird side of them that says, yeah, I like detective stories, but I also like, you know,
romance,
dirty science fiction set on whatever, you know. And how do you, you know,
I would read the hell out of that book.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
you take a look at like, I mean, how hard would it have been to have found a publisher, for the Firefly series if it had come out as a book? Joss Whedon's little Western in space. You know, the only reason that one got made like that was because it was Joss Whedon.
Right. He had the name recognition.
But someone that had come out, if somewhat unknown, you know, writer had come up with Firefly, how the hell would have that gotten out there, either as a TV series or a book or whatever?
Well, now, only within the last 5 years, I would say, has self-publishing really become well-respected and financially viable enough that those people who simply cannot find a home, not because of a lack of merit in the work, but because it doesn't fit into a marketing box, they can publish it themselves. In fact, one of my favorite historical romance writers is named Courtney Milan, and she published traditionally for a while and wasn't selling as well as her publisher expected,
right?
Because maybe her characters were a little on the wonky side. Mm-hmm. Like, she had a dyslexic hero. She had a courtesan heroine who was trying to seduce a virgin hero. And her publisher, you know, they loved her work, but they weren't able to market it in a way that spoke to its uniqueness, maybe. Like saying this is a historical romance and not emphasizing its uniqueness didn't serve it well. And now she is self-publishing and doing better than ever. Like just hitting every list, having professional respect, building her readership. And that's all within like the last 3 years.
Right.
So it's wonderful to know that's an option for people who want to write outside the box.
It is an option. One part of me is like, you know, all right, cool, go for it. But the other thing is, one of the interesting things I often find is when people bring up and become champions of self-publishing is that we tend to skip over some very important things that should be done by the self-published writer.
And one of,
right. Actually hiring an editor.
Absolutely.
You know, because, you know, your mom, your sister, your friend or whatever, they're great, but they have a personal investment in you to the point where they're, even if they're aware of it, they're still going to maybe pull a punch. They're not going to be as hard on you as an editor for hire is. And I just wish that every self-published fanfic weirdo would go out there and at least hire an editor. It doesn't even have to be an expensive, terribly good editor, but someone who will just come back with them and say, you know, this is working, this is not working.
You
keep misspelling the word can't.
Yeah.
You know?
Readers are smart. You know, if you get a book that is just almost unreadable because of all the errors, you're not going to get another one by that person.
Right.
But I think the most successful self-publishers they act as their own publisher. They hire a content editor. They have a great cover done. Mm-hmm. They market it smartly because you're now the only one responsible for connecting your book with readers.
Right. And I think in order to be a successful self-publisher, you have to go out and you have to learn about the publishing industry.
Totally. Absolutely.
Because if you're going to self-publish, you've got to act like a publisher. And, you know, that includes making hard decisions, you know, hiring editors, hiring book designers, hiring a marketer, you know, what else? Book designers, you know,
Oh,
finding
yeah, there's
something,
a
and
big
that,
deal. Yeah. Getting the
you
ebook
know.
file formatted for all these different
Oh yeah.
platforms.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's, and
Oh yeah, it's a huge
you've got to,
amount of
you need to know about returns. You need to know how the review system works so that you're not expecting like the New York Times to review your self-published book when they're never going to review it. You know?
Yeah, they don't look a lot at genre regardless.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's you really need to learn how it works right now, and then because the only way you're going to be able to subvert the publishing system enough to be successful, is either you have, you know, a relentless, you know, self-promotional attitude, a little bit of extra money that most people don't have, a lot of time, and you know, or something really, really gimmicky.
That could, yeah, having a gimmick like that can, it could get you attention in the short term, like the dinosaur erotica thing you mentioned.
Or the Yeti erotica.
Yes.
Oh, God.
You can't see this, but Jason is doing things with his arm. We're
Just.
Skyping and I can see all the faces he's making.
I
He really,
know.
he's thinking about writing Yeti erotica. He's already plotting it. Yeah, no, I think it is everything you're saying is totally true. It's not only writing the book, but also running the entire business side of it. I imagine the time commitment is just huge. And
Yeah. That's why I think some of the most.
word of mouth is always going to
Yeah.
be the best way to build a readership, and that's only going to come from having a quality work.
Right. That is true. That is very true. And I'm glad you agreed to talk with me and that we're having this conversation because this is kind of it's one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about lately. You know, been I haven't gotten around to reading Neil Gaiman yet. I've read a little bit of Michael Chabon. Kind of reluctant to read Jennifer Egan. And these are all so-called literary writers who have begun to mix genres into their stuff. And I'm thinking the way that you know the way the New York publishing industry is going and the way self-publishing is going is that those of us who, and that includes everybody, whether they're starting off in genre or whatever, anybody who's really interested in reading, not just as a pastime, but as something that's really significant to the course of human development. I mean, I don't think we would have the society or the culture that we have, both good and bad, if we weren't first storytelling animals.
Sure.
You know, this it's the way we store and convey, you know, this information. And what fiction stores and conveys is emotional, psychological, personal development, interaction,
Yes.
and moves that forward. Some scientists call it like dual inheritance theory, gene culture coevolution. And so, from that point of view, for me, the survival of good storytelling is important. Otherwise, we're going to have nothing but reality TV. And did you ever read If on a Winter's Night, A Traveler by Italo Calvino?
No, I haven't.
Oh my. It's very bizarre, postmodernist, weird thing at the heart of which is a storytelling machine that has broken down
Ha.
and
Is it a
is,
novel? I'll get it.
yep.
Tell me the title again. I'm writing it down.
If on a Winter's Night, A Traveler.
Okay, got it.
Author's last name is Calvino. Calvino.
I've heard of him. Oh, that's funny. Roald Dahl wrote a short story about that too. I won't be able to remember the title, but it's about a machine that creates fiction. He was pretty hard on romance. He was like, you push this lever and you stand on this pedal, and every once in a while you put in a weird word so people think a human being wrote it. And but the story is written in that way too, and it has like one strange word in there. It was like this meta
Oh, wow.
story, as though the machine had written the story. It was really entertaining to me, though, now as a romance writer. I'm like, hey, but of course he wrote it like 60 years ago.
Right. No, that's fabulous. And I think the way that you experience the publishing world, the way I've experienced it, and then you compared against some of the experiences that I've learned from other writers I've talked to who have managed to either get into the academic system or are kind of, well, like Brian up in Minnesota, he works for a publishing company and then writes. So
Oh, okay.
he's
So he's got
you
a
know in a
totally
whole
different
other
perspective.
yeah he's got a slightly different perspective on it all than all of us. And that's one of the things I really enjoy finding or talking to people about, is that I think if we as writers get out of our little ghettos, you know, just because I write so-called literary fiction and you write romance and he writes, you know, a combination of YA and middle readers and, you know, there's other people doing whatever. You know, if we actually get out and put our noggins together, maybe we can save ourselves. And kind of break down those genre barriers and get people to kind of take a risk when they pick up a book and get out of their own quasi ghettos and take a chance, because marvelously fancy, fun stuff in books, if you just play around, you
Sure.
know?
Yeah. And what I've heard from a lot of authors and what I know myself is, gosh, the readers are there. The problem may not be that there's no audience, but it's how do you find the audience, and how do you let them know, hey, something you might think is really cool is right here. And that the there's no easy answer to that, because if we had the answer, we would all be selling a ton of books.
We wouldn't have to have day jobs.
Yes, we would. Yeah, and that would be great for everyone, but organic word of mouth is the closest we can come, but that's a slow process. It's a slow build. But I will buy anything that a friend recommends to me. They tell me, if they told me, oh, what was the book you described before? If it was like fantasy set on Mars, science fiction, I don't remember. But if you told me,
It might have had romance, sci-fi's Yeti bondage. I don't know.
no Yetis, no Yetis, you and your
And
Yetis.
I'm obsessed with that right now for some reason. I don't think I have the nerve to actually read one of the books, but I can't stop thinking about
Please be sure to put that in whatever tag you put on this podcast. This is the one where we talk about Yetis.
Yetis.
Yeah. No, not any of that. But if a friend lets me know that a story had all those different elements and they enjoyed it, I love pushing out of the box and finding something, or something that's on the very edge of the box, or that's maybe between two boxes, to continue the image probably a little too far. When
Something that's actually a polygon.
it's a right. It's a D20, and I love it. That's great to know, isn't it? Like, oh, I hadn't heard of this book, but it sounds really cool. and I'll go for it. So if anybody ever figures out that awesome way to connect readers, you know, I know there are email lists, there are wonderful blogs, but just by the nature of writing and reading being made up of all these individuals, I don't think there's ever going to be a single
Right.
coordinated way any more than there already is.
Yeah. And I think if we really want to solve the reader problem, well, first off, I think, yeah, a lot of people have their own preferences, and it's not anything we can really do about. Some people prefer to run, some people prefer to ride bikes, some people prefer to read, and some people prefer to watch TV. But I honestly think that there's a certain level of what do we want, what do I want to call it? Of sabotage going on in the school systems.
What's
And
that?
well,
I haven't been in school for a really long time. Not that you heard me say that. I'm
well,
totally young.
it's not so much a sabotage when you get to the collegiate level, because the damage is kind of already done at that point. I think it's more of a sabotage in the grade school and the high school level, and I'm mostly drawing this from my personal experience. And well, one, I was not in the advanced AP English stuff like that. I was a terrible student in high school, especially with English class. And you know, of course, I was certainly not a remedial student. I was an early reader. I read a lot. I wasn't the most advanced reader. I was like, you know, there were the kids that were like reading four grade levels above themselves in grade school, and I was only two grade levels above, you know,
Holy.
because I preferred comic books and football.
Oh my gosh, you sound like my husband. No, he would read anything that had a superhero in it. And so if like they had turned War and Peace into a graphic novel at that time, he totally would have read it. He would have, because it had panels, anything that had panels. Yeah.
So I was in the regular English classes, and you know, there was like the Norton Anthology of Literature and stuff like this that they used there. And you've probably got one there.
I have four volumes behind me on the shelves here. I love
And
the Norton Anthology, but that's from my
yeah.
English major days, not high school or anything.
Well, I think they're well, I think Norton might not be the right one, but in high school the anthologies were not that great. You know, they weren't always the best stories by the right by these writers because the stories had to be gotten cheaply. So, you know, these textbook companies couldn't always afford, you know, the best stories by those writers because those tended to cost more to get the rights for them. And then all I remember really from my high school English class was the teacher getting up there trying to get 25 students to all agree that Faulkner's story, The Bear, meant this one certain thing.
I just it, if I put my head down on my desk now, it will probably mess up the recording, but that's what I want to do.
So, did
that's
you
not
have
the
that
kind of
experience?
experience that will make someone fall in love with literature, usually.
Right. And, you know, with those, and what I think that does is that the kids that read it, and, you know, for one reason, you know, just maturity level, you know, when I was in graduate school, somebody pointed out the fact that, you know, that just because you start a book and it doesn't stick doesn't mean that it's not good. You just might not be psychologically, you know, intellectually, your brain might not be ready to take that in. And I thought about that for a little while. And then I had an experience that, well, I recalled two things. I recalled an experience. My first time trying to read the Satanic Verses, I was lost. Then I put it down, a couple months later, went back, picked it up, and it made sense. And then in graduate school, I had the same thing with Lawrence Durrell's book Justine, the first of the Alexandria Quartet. I started reading it, and it really didn't click, didn't sit, and I put it aside. About 6 months later, I picked it up, and everything just fell right into place, and it resonated. And I blew through that one and the next three books all in about 2 months.
Oh, isn't that wonderful when it happens?
Oh, I love that.
Feel like you found the right book at the right time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you have kids in these classrooms, and that might not be the right story for them at the right time.
Yeah.
So they don't get it. And then the teacher's telling them you have to have an answer for this question about what it means, and I don't think it means anything right now. And they say, well, it has to mean this. And then you got the people like me in the back of the room are going, I don't think it means what the teacher says it means. I think it means this. And everybody's kind of being told they're wrong unless they agree with the teacher. And for the person that's not ready to for that story, they begin to think they're stupid and that these stories, they'll never get those stories. And so they go to, you know, the formulaic, you know, well, adventure.
Worst cases, they stop reading at all.
And exactly, they stop reading altogether. Or people like me, you
stop listening to your teacher.
You stop listening to the teachers and you stop paying attention in class, or, and you go out and you do things like get the satanic verses because nobody's teaching it and nobody's going, and you know everybody's got it wrong. And you're over there with the book on. I know what it's about.
Oh, well, I have to say that wasn't my experience with English, mm-hmm. thankfully, because that sounds like a miserable way to spend an English class when you think, I love to read. English is going to be my thing. In my high school English classes, we had to do the usuals like Romeo and Juliet and whatever, mm-hmm. but... we also read some really quirky stuff like Equus and what was the name of that weird play? The Visit, where everyone in town has to, they're all thinking about wanting to inherit a fortune, but they have to kill one of their fellow townspeople to inherit it. And so
wow,
Durrenmatt, I want to say, is the author.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just, it's like, it was really funny, but really
right.
dark. And so as a class, I think we enjoyed it a lot
mm-hmm.
because teenagers, you know, they like dark stuff.
Yeah.
They like something that acknowledges that things can be dark, but also mm-hmm. funny.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I think that's how the teenage mind works. And so finding literature that was a good fit for keeping us engaged mm-hmm. made the class fun. And ideally, that would always be able to happen.
Right, right. Yeah. And I've had people, I've brought up that my experience with it and stuff like that, and they've decided that I was all just full of shit because their personal experience trumps anybody else's experience.
No, your personal experience is yours. I mean, how can I say you didn't have a miserable time in English class? I can say is that... It wasn't like that for me, and so I hope mm-hmm. it wasn't like that for everybody.
Right, but that doesn't mean it wasn't. That's the thing that I kind of wish people would wake up and realize is that, you know, when you do have somebody you run into who says, you give them a book, and they say something like, "Oh, that's too smart for me." No, it's not. God, I want to wring those people's necks, you know, just...
You're smarter
it's like,
than you know.
You're smarter than you think. It's people don't have... A lot of people have had a certain amount of trust and belief and faith in their native intelligence kind of beaten out of them. And I think that's regrettable and that's sad. It opens them up to manipulations. It opens them up to being manipulated, and it opens them up to... Well, it closes off their lives a little bit.
Mm-hmm. If they get in the habit
and it
of
limits
teaching.
Them.
Yeah.
And I think this is a new idea. Just in the last couple of weeks after talking to Timothy Shafford, his podcast will be out on Monday and yours will be out two weeks after that. Yeah.
Cool. Hi, Timothy.
He's awesome, but... So it's this new idea is that we, and also from the MFA versus NYC thing, is that we as writers, we don't have to try and compete with TV and movies and things like that, because right. we have a strength that they can't get to, and that's the ability to actually crawl inside the thought processes.
Totally. Yeah. Feeds a different need or desire. It's different. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a different niche, but it still gets to that same need and desire behind why we tell a story. It's just the form's different than TV and movies. There's a certain opaqueness with those that fiction is able to break down.
Yeah. By being able to get inside a character's
head. Actually, get inside the thought process. Yeah. That kind of empathetic imagination is incredibly valuable. And
that's my favorite part of writing. Totally.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why I hate two types of writing. One where they use stereotypical characters and a lot of emotional cliche as a kind of a shorthand. When somebody's sitting there going, I was mad as hell. You and I have a different concept of the degree of madness that makes up that cliche, mad as hell. You know?
Yeah.
And so when somebody's using emotional cliche, what it basically is it creates a self-reflective state, a kind of emotional confirmation bias. Because if you are forced to fill in what the writer meant by mad as hell with what you understand to be mad as hell, then anybody that has a different definition is going to be unintelligible to you.
Well, if I'm reading something like that, I tend to feel a little distanced from the story, as opposed to just sinking into it and being able to fall into it. Like, to take an example, I read this book called The Evolution of Shadows not long ago. My daughter's like, what are you reading? What are you reading? I was like, leave me alone. Because they're drifting through time and you're always so deep inside someone's point of view. And it just felt, you know, if I hadn't known who was talking, I still would have known. Like if there hadn't been a tag to tell me we're in Leanne's point of view, mm-hmm. I would have still known it was her because it was so deeply her perspective. And that is...
Thank you.
He's turning kind of red. It's Jason's book.
Well, it's a good thing I got the earphones on because you can't see my little ears turn pink.
I really enjoyed that. It really rang true to me.
Thank you.
And if a book doesn't have that, then I don't sink into it in the same way.
Right.
And in my own writing, when I go back and read over it and revise it, I always want to dig deeply and not skate on the surface because I want to give as close an approximation as I can to the fact that these are real people with complex emotions. I mean, I know they're not real. I made them up, but I think it does the best service to the story and to the reader if those layers are there.
Right. You do a very good job of that, by the way.
Oh, okay.
You do a very good job of that. So you don't have to worry. You're succeeding.
Oh, well, thank you. I really appreciate that. Did you have time to read the newest one that I looked at?
I haven't.
Okay.
I have not. No, I'm deep into Timothy's book, which I didn't get read before he was here, but fortunately I've read some of his other stuff. I mean,
too many books, too little time. That's always the way.
And I'm writing a review for something else, so I had to get that read this week because that book comes out soon. And then moving and furniture shopping. I have two office chairs to my name right now.
Oh. Yeah, that's it. Anytime you're dealing with a upheaval outside of the regular is tough. Yeah.
And besides, the one you send me is going to be the sequel to the first one, which I haven't gotten to yet, so.
It Takes Two to Tangle?
Yeah.
You've read the season ones, I know.
I've read the first two season ones.
Yes, he used the phrase man card. Dear podcast, when he wrote about my first two books, he wondered if he would be able to retain his man card after reading books with pink covers. The answer is absolutely yes. Now, if you like, I can tell you the story of how I got my husband to start reading romance. Not that he doesn't read it a lot. Mostly he reads things on his phone and doing the gesture of holding the smartphone. And yeah,
right.
Like whatever is a headline, he always knows what's going on all over the world. And he reads tech magazines. Mm-hmm. But when I wanted to start reading romance, you know, he's a really easygoing guy. He was like, okay, great. Good for you. And I said, well, do you want to read one? Here's this book that I have fallen in love with. And right. if you read it, then you'll know what excellent historical romance writing is like. And then you can tell me if I suck or not. And right. he was like, okay. So he read this book. I think one of the first ones I gave him was Not Quite a Husband by Sherry Thomas, which it gives me the arm prickles every time I talk about it. It's so anguished. It's so adventurous. it's beautifully written. Beautiful, beautiful. So he read it and he said, this is a great adventure novel, but it also has sex in it. If men knew this, they would read romance yeah. all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's some, if it's done well. But then again, maybe some guys aren't as discriminating when it comes to literary sex as I am. I mean, before reading yours, my only exposure to the sex in romance novels, was something my mother had floating around the house because she used to sign up for like the monthly Harlequin service to like get the free gift, and then she would never buy any of the books, or she would buy just
the free gift. I've always wondered.
Oh, I think one time it was like a set of God, this was in the '80s. It was like a set of steak knives.
Wow, that's pretty sweet.
And you know, so. One day, you know, just being the horrible, malicious, you know, 17-year-old that I was, I picked up one of those books and was, you know, just kind of skimming through it,
looking for the dirty bits. You were, yeah.
Looking for the dirty bits, but also reading things out loud, you know, to embarrass my mom and my sister, you know, following them around the house with the book and going, and then, you know.
Oh man, and, I would die if anyone did that. If you read something out of context. Here, let me just grab one of my books. Okay. Here. This is the new one. This is coming out in May. Okay. Well, that's not as stupid as I thought it might be. Okay.
Well, listen, you're going to have to really search, and I think you're going to have to use somebody else's book to find anything worse than man root.
I do not use the word man root. But, yeah, what is going on in this scene? I haven't read this book for a long time. Oh, I kind of like this part. Okay, well, yes. So her grasp was tighter than ever, her fingers tight as unsheathed claws. If young Miss Weatherby had been a kitten, Augusta Meredith was a tigress. All right, so there you go. Now, hopefully, yeah. If you're reading the book, it doesn't sound as melodramatic as I just made it, but
yes, a lot of things out of context. A lot of things out of context are definitely going to sound bad. you don't have to convince me of that. I don't know how many times I've been taken out of context for weird things I've said, and you know, a lot of it happened in graduate school. You know, I would make some strange pronouncement, you know, and it would come back to me like a week later as Jason doesn't read anything that was, you know, published before the 20th century. It's like, that's not exactly what I said.
And what's wrong with that? No, I really could never be a politician because I say so many things that could be made to sound very stupid if you put them in a soundbite. Yeah.
I know that feeling, yeah.
Maybe this is why we type more than we talk.
Yeah, it's because you get to revise.
That's right.
even then sometimes I miss a few things, which is why I love editors.
They're saints. They are total saints. Yeah.
Well, okay, so let's review here. Where is it? Oh, I shut that down.
Stop recording us, did you? That would be so sad.
No.
Okay.
Let's go here. I shut down the browser with your page up.
Oh.
Okay. Just review here for the assembled crowd.
Ain't no party like an Outrider party.
Yeah. Okay. Woo-hoo. So the first series of books is the Season series. The three that are out there right now are Season for Temptation, Season for Surrender, and Season for Scandal, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and you've got Season for Desire coming out in October of this year.
Correct.
It Takes Two to Tangle from your Matchmaker series is out. And May, you're going to have To Charm a Naughty Countess coming out, and then another one in 2015.
That's right. Yep.
Cool. So if people want to find your stuff, they know what the titles are. And of course, I'll link to your webpage and everything when we put up the site notes.
Oh, thanks. Yes. It's just TeresaRomain.com, and that's Teresa with an H and Romain with an R-O-M-A-I-N. it's not a name people come across very often, so.
Yeah. It'll be cool. But so anyway, yes. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks Teresa. So much. This was really was fun, nice. And I'm glad I wasn't able to destroy any of your equipment with spilled coffee this
time. The pen is just fine. It has survived.
Oh,
don't worry.
You're such a good sport. Thanks.
Thanks, Teresa. All right. That was my conversation with Teresa Romain. Come back in 2 weeks where we'll have my conversation with the poet Ed Skoog. See you in 2 weeks.